Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
That we got going on, of course, not just this show, but all of our shows with Beyond the Cover, Story Blender, Crime and Science Radio, and much more here on Suspense Radio, bringing you the very best in author interviews, industry news, and so much more. I'm your host, John Robb, and we are joined today with two fabulous authors. First, we're going to kick it off with Ellen Kirstman talking about her book, The Right Wrong Thing, and we're going to finish it up with Bonnie McBird talking about The Art in the Blood, and it's a Sherlock Holmes adventure, so that should be interesting to see her spin on Sherlock Holmes. But let's jump right in now to our first guest, and again, her name is Ellen Kirstman, and the book is called The Right Wrong Thing. So, Ellen, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, and thank you for doing this an hour earlier, because like I said, it's my daughter's birthday today. We're going out and doing some things, so it's good that we're able to get a little bit of a head start on the L.A. traffic, and who knows what the weather's going to be like today. So again, I want to thank you for coming on this hour early.
Not a problem. It's what I preach, family first.
So let's jump into your book, The Right Wrong Thing. It is the latest book that you have going on in a series. It's Scott Meyerhoff Mystery Series. Now, this is the first book in the series, am I correct?
No, Burying Ben was the first book.
Oh, okay, this is the second one, my fault. So, tell everybody a little bit about what you have going on about The Right Wrong Thing. And since now that this is just book two, it's good to maybe kind of go back and catch maybe a people up to let them know who Dot Meyerhoff is and kind of the behind-the-scenes look into what you got going on.
Okay. So, for the last 30 years, I have been and still am a police psychologist, and I'm also the author of three nonfiction books for law enforcement and first responders. After I wrote the third one, I thought, geez, it's got to be easier to make things up, and I've got all these stories and all of these experiences over the 30 years. I'm going to try to talk about contemporary police issues using fiction. And so I created Dot Meyerhoff, who is my fictional counterpart. She is a police psychologist for the Kenilworth Police Department in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley specifically. I made the name because Dot was my mother's name and Meyerhoff is my grandmother's name. Dot is a consultant to this department, and in the first book, and all of my books are based on actual composites of people I have treated as a police psychologist. So one of the things that has always perplexed me, I've always wondered what would happen if I had a client who killed themselves. So in Burying Ben, and police psych, by the way, police suicide is an issue that for years was never talked about. Your listeners may not know that cops are 2 to 3 times as likely to kill themselves as they are to be killed in the line of duty. And for a population that has to be well screened before they get their jobs, that's a pretty alarming statistic. So Burying Ben is about a young rookie cop who's still in the field training program, and this is not a spoiler because you learn this in the first page. He kills himself and leaves a note blaming his psychologist, Dr. Dot Meyerhoff. And the dot then needs to get at the truth and bring the responsible people to justice. And in doing so, you get to meet a whole bunch of other police characters, including Ben's field training officer, Eddie Rimbauer, who is sort of a central casting, send-me-up-a-badge-heavy cop who talks really badly about a lot of things. The second book is called The Right Wrong Thing, and it bears a striking resemblance to the recent headlines in the newspaper, although I began writing it before Ferguson occurred. And it's about a young rookie officer, a white female by the name of Randy, who is having a hard time finding acceptance as a woman at the Kenilworth PD because she is accused of backing off in a fight and leaving her partner to be injured. In a way, she begins to overreact to that reputation and be tougher than she really is or feels or maybe needs to be. And she shoots and kills an unarmed African-American pregnant teenager by mistaking that young woman's cell phone for a gun. And the story is then what happens both to Randy, to the Kenilworth Police Department. There's a lot of community protesting what happens to the dead girl's family and how Dot tries to help Randy, who is suffering with PTSD, and all she wants to do, she feels so terrible about having killed this young woman that she wants to apologize to the family with some disastrous results. So those are essentially, and quickly, the plots of my two stories. And I've got a work in progress now. I'm about finished, I hope, with my third book, which involves the stress, strain, and deterioration of an ICAC investigator. That means Internet Crimes Against Children. And I don't want to say any more about that because it's still pretty much in first draft stage. So there you have it.
And that plot line is kind of, I guess you want to say, in the news right now with the whole Jared Fogle thing. What they were going on, because that's kind of along those lines, but it's been going on for years like that. So
now tell me who Jared. I don't know that name.
Jared Fogle. He was the Subway spokes that got in trouble for. He just got in trouble for child pornography, and the person who founded his or was the head of his, I guess, foundation or charity was the ringleader of doing this. But Fogle got. You would know Jared. Jared was the Subway guy. He was the guy who lost all the weight eating the Subway, and he just got busted.
Oh, yes. I'm a former New Yorker. I was thinking of a real Subway. You mean the Subway sandwiches? Yeah.
The Subway
okay.
sandwiches, yeah.
All
yeah.
right. Now
and
I'm
so,
with you.
And, of course, you know, with all the TV shows, you know, To Catch a Predator and things like that, I don't
right.
think a lot of people maybe fully understand the psyche of what goes into those kinds of things. And so when you decided to create Dot and kind of put her as a, you know, and as a police psychologist, what's the one thing that a lot of people are miss that you're kind of busting that maybe people think what police psychologists are? Because I think it's one of those jobs that is a little mysterious to people like myself because you just don't really hear about them and what they are and how involved they get and maybe who they are as, you know, within their profession.
Well, exactly. The most people get their impression from police off of television, which is really the wrong place to learn anything accurate, or because they might have had an interaction themselves. But there's a lot of stereotyping about policing, and I'm hoping to sort of I look behind the curtain about what's the emotional price that people pay for being a police officer. I mean, being a cop is one of the most complex professions I know of. what other jobs where you have to be an enforcer, you have to be a social worker, a judge, a priest, a counselor, a lawyer. It's a very, very complex job that's done under, often under the most difficult of circumstances. So I'm hoping that through my mysteries, people will learn more about the reality of policing, particularly the psychological and emotional effects it has on the officer and the officer's friends and family.
Mm-hmm. And when you write about a profession like this and something that is mysterious, how much leeway do you give to fiction and nonfiction? Because I'm sure that some of the nonfictional things that a police psychologist does probably doesn't lend his hands too well to get involved with a thriller suspense book. So I'm sure you have to take some liberties. Do you kind of explain a little bit about maybe within the book, or do you kind of have an area where people can go and understand maybe what you had to fictionalize to what maybe how it works?
Well, most of what is fictionalized in the book would be the things that Dot does. So, for example, people are always asking me, is this book autobiographical? Did you really do those things? And my answer is no. I mean, Dot has some skills that I never had as a psychologist, breaking and entering, posing as a public official, and assault with a deadly weapon. I never did any of that stuff. So, you know, and you're absolutely right. You have to be an incredibly good writer to make something interesting out of a therapy session with long silences. You know, the reader, that doesn't translate really well to the page unless you're a pretty exceptional author. So I don't know that I explain that in any detail. In Burying Ben, I do offer some resources for that I have groups I've worked with for suicide prevention amongst police, and I do explain a little bit in the introduction or the acknowledgments where, you know, what's different, what's fictional and not fictional. I can say that what's fictional and what's different about me and Dot is that she is younger than I am. She's thinner than I am. She takes more risks than I do. She is, I have people ask me about her. She has a romantic interest, and his name is Frank. And people who know me know I have plagiarized my husband's entire life to create the character of Frank. So everybody knows that's real right there.
Very good. The other thing is that, you know, within the book, The Right Wrong Thing, and again, we are speaking here with author Ellen Kirschman, and you can go to ellenkirschman.com, that's KirschMan.com for more information on this book and the previous one, which was the first in her series. And the one thing that I'm always curious about, too, when I look at professional books and basically occupations that I'm not familiar with is, you know, you have your officer here, Randy Spelling, and, you know, she does something that, of course, is very, very, you know, upfront in the news right now. I mean, it's like with all the officer shootings and things like that. But the one thing that we don't hear about is, what happens now? Because you always hear about the officer and people want them to be, you know, they want them to be charged and arrested and they want them thrown in jail and the book thrown at them. But when it's truly a mistake and it's truly something that they did not mean to do, now you don't hear about what the psychological and the things they have to go through on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm.
That's
exactly
where you kind of come in now. So
right.
Explain kind of that kind of relationship between the psychologist and an officer that truly did something that is haunting them. Because, you know, I'm sure that there are officers out there that probably do not care, but most of them, when they do something like this, it haunts them for a very long time. So can you kind of explain that relationship?
Sure.
And how that works out in the book, that's something that people don't understand?
But that's a great question and an important question, too. When I have often said that police officers kind of swing between two polarized points. On the one end, that might be remorse for things they have done, and at the other side is remorse for things they didn't do. That's one of the things that makes, one of the reasons that policing is such a complex profession, because you make these important decisions with great consequences to yourself and other people, usually in the middle of the night when it's dark and it's raining and you can't see what's going on and you have a split second to make up your mind. So even when a shooting, if we talk now just specifically about shootings, because another reality of policing is that most officers will never shoot their guns in the line of duty, except when they're on the firing range. There's cops do a whole wide range of other things that affect them emotionally, too. Mostly, the thing we see that is most difficult for a police officer to handle is anything involving a child. So in a shooting, in the aftermath of an officer-involved shooting, even if the shooting is deemed justified and legal, it can, for some people, not everybody, leave them with post-traumatic stress injury, I like to call it, because a disorder sounds like something you'll never get over, but we all know we can't
right.
get repair ourselves from injuries. So Randy Spelling is based on a real client of mine, and this person whose shooting was under different circumstances but was totally justified, had nightmares, was afraid to go outside, felt in both cases my real client and Randy Spelling were women, and they'd been having a very hard time achieving respect from their male counterparts until they killed somebody, and now suddenly they'd become heroes. And that was repellent to them to have their circumstances change because they never got into the business to kill anybody, which is true for most police officers. 99 9/10% get into the field of policing because they want to help and make a difference in the world. So people get withdrawn after a shooting. The kind of uproar that happens in the media, that happens in the community, depending upon the status of the person that's been shot and killed, they feel totally exposed. Their families are exposed. Their children get taunted at school or treated badly by teachers. Their spouses, their non-enforcement spouses, get cornered in the grocery store from people asking questions born out of ignorance, like why didn't they shoot him in the leg? Cops are not trained
right.
to do that. There's a whole host of things. Somehow the joy of the job is gone, and cops are afraid that the next time they're in a situation where they might have to shoot somebody, they're afraid either that they will overreact or be too slow to react and get killed or get somebody else killed. The other thing, I also am part of an organization called the First Responders Support Network, where we take first responders, mostly cops, on a six-day retreat, and these are all people who have post-traumatic stress injuries. And one of the factors we see that makes these kinds of critical incidents, like shootings, worse than they should be is something we call betrayal. Either it's betrayal from your administration or betrayal from a friend or a fellow officer or feeling that the community that you have tried to serve is now betraying you by calling, you know, for your dismissal. So their betrayal always makes the actual incident much more difficult because people say, look, I expect the bad guys to try to hurt me. What I don't expect is that my organization might not have my back in the way they promised.
Okay.
Yeah. And those dynamics figure really pretty strongly in both of my books because it's so much a part of my work.
Right. And I think that when you put that kind of emotion and you put yourself into works and into a book like that, that you have to get, that this is almost maybe a way of, I guess, healing yourself in a way, because you're holding on to all these things. And, you know, as a psychiatrist, it's got to be very difficult from that aspect, because you're taking in so much from so many different people that this is kind of therapeutic, was it not, to maybe write the book and maybe get some things out that you always have to hold in all the time and keep secrets, because you're always a secret keeper. That's going to be difficult.
Right. Well, bingo, John. I mean, most people don't get that. But I like to say that writing fiction, because now I can take my psychologist hat off and put my writer hat on, was a great opportunity for payback. I got to write things about cops who have not treated me well or respectfully, cops who refused ever to trust me. I got payback for some of my fellow psychologists and a couple of ex-husbands. I mean, it was really fun.
Yeah, and I would think that, you know, when you're going forward and you're going to continue the series, because this is definitely an opening in the series where you have no, it's not like, you know, you're going to write 5 books and you're done or something like that. This is something that can go on in forever. Do you have kind of ideas about how you want that to go? Do you, without maybe giving things away, you don't have to, but do you kind of have that idea of how you kind of want her to go, or is it just going to be a surprise with every book about what happens to her or how things are going to be developed?
No, I do have some ideas. For one thing, I'm going to age her. She starts out, and she's close to 50. My books are different from many other books in that my protagonist is older, and there aren't really too many books involving police work that are told from the point of view not of the cop, but of the psychologist who's treating the cop.
Right.
So she will age. Her romance with Frank will deepen, and they will my husband is really hoping that will happen. But he comes to my book readings and says things about he hopes Frank gets lucky in the next book. So
right.
I think they will probably get married, and so then we'll have something of ordinary life and the stresses and strains of being married. You know, what's that all about? And I think she's going to get, I'm still debating about this, but I think she's going to get wiser and do fewer off-the-wall things like the breaking and entering and assault with a deadly weapon. I think she is going to let other characters in the book take those kinds of physical risks that she's taken and get more into using her brains, her wisdom. And she's a very big-hearted person. I mean, the reason she does some of this stupid stuff that she's done is that she cares deeply, as I do, for the officers that she treats. She sees how difficult their jobs are and how well-meaning even a horrible mistake like Randy makes can be. So those are some of the ways that I see her character, I guess the word I'd use is deepening. That's what I predict for the future.
Gotcha. Now, real quick, because we're kind of running out of time here, but I always like to kind of get an idea. I mean, Ocean View is a wonderful publisher. We know many people over there, and they've been doing a great job. So how did you kind of get involved? How was your journey to get published with them with this series?
Ah, well, you're absolutely right. They are totally wonderful. I had another publisher when Burying Ben was first published, a very small publisher, and they after the book came out, they went out of business. So when I was able to get an agent, I had the agent while we were trying to sell Burying Ben. And then the way I got to Ocean View was through a wonderful mystery author by the name of Mike Orendoff, who writes the Pot Thief series. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but his protagonists steals Indian pots and resells them, and is a very smart and wise guy. And Mike was publishing with Ocean View at the time, and he introduced me to them because he had also been with that first small publisher, and they bought the book. And then they bought Burying Ben as well, so he didn't stay buried, which was good. and they've been absolutely terrific. These people are smart and have gone about setting up their publishing business really in a very wise way. They're very calm. They're very, you know, they've been terrific. I've been very happy with them. As to my path to publishing, you know, for your readers that are trying to get published, I, you know, my only advice is patience. Write a good book. Make sure it is the best book possible. And then you're going to just have to, like everybody, even the world's most famous writers, have received a gajillion rejections. And the publishing world is, as everybody knows, very difficult and changing almost daily. So, you know, stick with it. Don't never give up. I am a very persistent person. It takes a lot for me to quit anything. And that's true for Dot Meyerhoff as well. So don't give up. Keep at it. Just keep your, make you sure you're writing a really good book that people want to read.
Well, Ellen, I mean, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been fabulous to speak with you. I want to thank you again for being here, and I wish you nothing but the best. And I'm sure that Ocean View will keep in touch with us with what you got going on in the future, but let's see if we can have you back on and talk a little bit more, because I think that, you know, Don is a fascinating character, and one, again, that I just, you know, really never seen written in suspense thriller work. So keep it up.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been great talking to you, and I do hope I come back. Happy holidays.
Absolutely. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Ellen Kirschman. You can check out ellenkirschman.com, K-A-R-S-C-H-M-A-N. The latest book is called The Right Wrong Thing. It is book two in her series about police psychologists, and that is very important because, again, that's something that's a little bit off the beaten path that you just don't hear every day. Her character's name is Dot Meyerhoff, so make sure you check that out. We're going to take a quick break, and we are going to be back with our next guest, Bonnie McBird, who is talking about Art in the Blood, and it's a Sherlock Holmes adventure book. So, while we all wait for that anticipation, here you go. Breakdown. welcome back, everybody. And before I forget, when we end the show, I want to let you know that this is our last Saturday show of the year. We will return back in 2016 in January. I forget, the January 9th or something to that effect. And we'll be back then. So this is our last Saturday show for this. Climate Science Radio will end next Saturday, and then they will be back in 2016. And Beyond the Cover, we are going to do a special show tomorrow, which will finish out our year for that one. And the Story Blender will end on Friday. So everything is pretty much going to be done by the Saturday for the holidays, and we are going to be out of here, taking a little bit of a break and having some new things coming on for next year. Jeff and I are developing a new show, which is going to be an old-time suspense radio series. So you're going to hear stories. It's going to be a serial story show that we are writing, and we are going to have episodes on there, 30 minutes probably each. And, of course, there'll be cliffhangers, and, you know, we're not going to leave you – it's not going to be that, you know, fulfilling at some times. You know, you're going to have to be waiting for the next ending, but we're doing all those fun things. So check us out. And, again, I just want to let everybody know that that's what we're doing for the end of the year. So thank you all again so much for joining us. And now – let's jump into our last guest here of basically of 2015. We're going to work it out that. So it's Bonnie McBird, and her book is called Art in the Blood. It's a Sherlock Holmes adventure. Always love anything to do with Sherlock Holmes. So, Bonnie, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you. I'm doing great.
And so, you know, I love Sherlock Holmes. I love everything to do about Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie and definitely Hercule Poirot that she wrote, and I love this detective. So when I saw that, you know, this was coming out, I said, yeah, I said, I want to get you on to talk about it because I love the different angles that people have. And then they still keep Sherlock Holmes alive now, what we're going on, God, what, 150 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, probably one of the longest running. So Art in the Blood is the latest book. Tell everybody about it. What do you got going on here with Sherlock Holmes now in 2015?
Well, thank you. Art in the Blood is a full-length novel, and it's written in the style of Arthur Conan Doyle. So I was emulating, you know, this writer because I think he's one of the most underrated in a literary sense. He's one of the most underrated and yet one of the most beloved writers of all time. People are still avidly reading him and loving him 130 years hence, you know. And so I think also he's got a legion of fans that are just very, very hardcore. A fandom in a way, you know, almost started with him, but certainly the modern detective novel is considered to have started with him. And what's interesting about Conan Doyle and what makes him so relevant today is that compared to other writers of his time, he was very modern in his sensibilities. That is, he was less wordy. He wrote his stories move like the wind. They're structured almost like screenplays. My novel's been called cinematic because I've been a screenwriter for years. But in fact, that's due to emulating Conan Doyle because he was very visual. He used a lot of dialogue. And I think for some of these reasons, you know, he still feels very, very fresh today.
Yeah. Now, I guess the question, of course, is what got you involved to wanting to do, you know, Sherlock Holmes? I mean, when did you kind of get this love for this, and then you decided that you wanted to now be involved and write a book?
Well, I fell in love with Sherlock Holmes at age 10. I had a lot of people came to Holmes as kids because you know it's often introduced to you as a young adult pretty much. It's not, you know, little kid stuff because there's all kinds of murders and adventure and so forth. But so I read the first Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, at age 10, and that was in fourth grade. And I was encouraged to read. And in my house, my parents had one of those huge dictionaries that sits open on a stand. And when I didn't know a word, you know, they told me to look it up and try to use it in a sentence and, you know, learn new words.
Right.
Anyway, I was
I was reading a lot of 19th century children's literature. Came with the Encyclopedia Britannica Junior that my parents bought for me, a little set that was very big back then. And in fourth grade, I wrote a short story, and the teacher read it and became completely shocked and sent it to the principal, and the principal called my mother into the office. And the principal said, you know, showed my mother the story and said, where did she learn this word? And my mother looked at it, and she started laughing, and she said, oh, she'll tell you tomorrow. She'll bring it in. And so the next day I brought into my class a study in Scarlet, and I showed them that ejaculated didn't mean what they thought. I was emulating Conan Doyle back then. Anyway, so,
exactly.
But, I know, this is so crazy. So flash forward to many, many years later, I've been a screenwriter for a long, long time, and I've written plays and other things, but writing a novel was a bucket list item, really, something I always wanted to do. And all of a sudden, I'd recovered from a serious illness. And sometimes when that happens, you know, it kind of focuses your thoughts, and it suddenly occurred to me, you know, it's like, life isn't infinite, you know? I mean, I'm fully recovered, but what do I really want to do? You know, what do I not want to miss doing? I want to write a novel. And I thought to myself, okay, that's going to take a while. It's not a casual, it's not a one-month commitment. It's a year
right.
or two. And who do I want to spend my time with? And who I wanted to spend my time with was Sherlock Holmes. And that just answer came very clear to me. And I thought, well, I want to do this because I'm a screenwriter. You know, I often think, kind of logistically or statistically or whatever. But I thought, well, this is not really that marketable because, first of all, it's past its, you know, we've got the Robert Downey Jr. films. We've got the BBC Sherlock. We've got Elementary.
Mm-hmm.
The world is flooded with Sherlock Holmes right now. So maybe this isn't that commercial. And the answer just came to me, like, I don't care. I really don't care.
Right.
This is how I want to spend my time. And, you know, I think you know, when you're a creative person, you have to listen to that inner voice. Because, I teach writing, too. And, most people tell students of writing to write what you know. And I don't ascribe to that at all. I say write what you love. Because when you write what you love, you know, the passion for it just shows through. But even more importantly, it gives you the stamina to take it all the way to being good. Because writing is rewriting. It takes a long time. And I knew that it was a commitment. If I was going to really do this, I wanted to really do it. And so I'm not going to just pen something and then send it off. You know, I wanted to really do it well. And so I set this challenge for myself to do it, to try to emulate this man who's, I think, a genius. And in order to emulate a writer, you have to understand really, really in depth what he's doing, or she. In this case, I made a study. I'd already read the things many, many times. I love Sherlock Holmes, as I said, since age 10. And I found myself, you know, getting re-inspired over and over. You know, first the black and white films with Basil Rathbone, and 7% Solution in the 70s, and then the Granada series in the 80s and 90s, and then the Downey films pulled me right back in, and then BBC Sherlock just was, you know, the cherry on top of the sundae. It was like, oh,
mm-hmm.
man, you know, I was so fired up. But I have been for years, years and years. So I thought, okay, this is my passion, and I don't care about how commercial it is or what. I want to learn everything I can about what Doyle did. How did he write? And what makes it so, you know, timeless and, you know,
right.
so loved. And so as a writer, from a craft standpoint, he does a number of really, really interesting things. And as I made a study of this to try to really emulate it, you know, that it was just an amazing writing challenge and lesson for me. And so I love challenges like that. I love to write to form. So I like to write sonnets. I like to write plays. I like form, formal form, because for an artist, form is freeing. It seems like it would constrain you to try to emulate another writer or to write a form, you know, like a sonnet. It seems like that would be a constraint, but I call them, and other people do as well, freeing constraints, because within the context of trying to hit these marks, it just somehow frees you to be very creative. And so anyway, this was a challenge that I just immediately thought, oh, how fun. I really want to do this. And so that sort of launched me.
And you kind of took a little bit of different look into Sherlock Holmes, because you bring in Jack the Ripper into this. You kind of put Holmes into this depression, back on his opiates. He's back on his drugs. He's doing his thing. And then you kind of have Watson and everything. Now, so I guess when you were developing the story, because there are so many different styles of Holmes out there and who he was, and now you have the new movie, Mr. Holmes, where he's older and this and that. When you decided to piece the story together, what was kind of your thinking into making it something that was different, something that was a little, that gave Sherlock Holmes a little bit more depth for people that have either devoured everything or also a different kind of spin for people who are just finding out about it, and maybe you're the first Holmes book that they have discovered?
That's a good question. I put some thought into that, and in terms of where did I want my book to fall in the larger world of the originals, plus all the pastiches and things that have been developed since. So my first thought was I wanted it to be as true to Conan Doyle as possible. So I'm very familiar with the canon. So I wanted to write a story that didn't negate anything that Conan Doyle had written. So it doesn't conflict with the creation of the character that as he has been created. My favorite sort of adaptations of Sherlock Holmes over the years have been ones that are closest to the original character. Now, that being said, I have to say I love BBC Sherlock, but one of the reasons I love it is that it is so closely inspired by the original. But the Granada series was trying to actually, bring exactly those things to the screen as close as possible. So, I love it, the real Conan Doyle. So I wasn't trying to create a new genre. I wasn't trying to negate anything that was in the canon. I set for myself a bunch of kind of lines in the sand that were my goals, in terms of fitting into mm-hmm. into the larger Sherlock Holmes world. So one of them was don't negate anything in the canon. One of them was I'll have all the deductions, which are just one of the delightful bits for everybody, have all of them be original. Because I don't personally like when people write pastiches and they recycle the ones that are already in Conan Doyle, like the scratched watch. And some of them
sure.
Recycle them almost verbatim. And I was like, that's cheating. You got to come up with new ones.
Right.
So that was one. But I also, canon, in the original stories, they're not strongly character driven, or they don't seem to be. But in fact, the friendship between these two men is probably the underpinning of the whole appeal of it. It's not just the mysteries and how smart he is. I mean, he's a brilliant man, and he's idiosyncratic. But there's two things that really pull us in. One is that friendship, which is so strong and so loving. And the thing is, we would all love to be a friend like Watson to someone, and we would all love to have a friend like Watson. So that had to be there. That had to be a very strong element. The other thing that is there is that Holmes himself is kind of a mystery. And so Conan Doyle gives us kind of sketches in and around the character, but he doesn't give us the full story. So, for example, Holmes is a little strange about women. He has, it's almost an aversion, or it seems like an avoidance. It might be from fear, it might be from misunderstanding, and what he says about it is, he doesn't have, it interferes with his thinking and his work. So, people have, posited many, many things about this over the years. But one of the appeals of this character is that he is a mystery himself. And so we don't know really how he feels about women. We don't really know why he takes drugs. Watson says, and he says also, that it seems to be because when he gets depressed, basically, when he's not working. The wheels are turning and they've got no, there's no road to go on. He's just, spinning. So in fact, Conan Doyle has described somebody that we would now almost think of as bipolar. And we also think maybe he's a little autistic. Those would be the modern takes on this personality. So one of the things I wanted to do is make it very true. But when we read the originals, when people read them, we we long for these little hints of character, and Conan Doyle just sprinkles them enough through that we, you know, so we get a feel for who this guy is, but we don't fully know him. So I wanted to do that. I wanted to build on that. I wanted to add a little bit of character to, a little bit more knowledge of character to him without contradicting what Conan Doyle had created. So that was one of my specific lines in the sand, was I'm going to hint at some things about him without negating, but just enough to, you know, give a little feel for who this guy is. I also decided, when, you know, Conan Doyle wrote 56 short stories and four novellas.
Wow.
But he never wrote a full-length novel starring Sherlock.
Right. And, you know, and I think that that's a big myth that a lot of people never really knew, that he never wrote a full-length novel. It was a lot of short stories. Even like Ian Fleming, it was kind of the same way. A lot of big, I think that's pretty interesting.
It is. It is. And, you know, that was his main medium. Now, Conan Doyle did write novels, and they were, a couple of them were more successful than others. But by and large, most people think that the short story was truly his best medium for his particular writing style and so forth. But when you write a novel as opposed to a short story, you are faced with structural challenges that the short story doesn't give you. So in a sense, so I knew I would have to do something about the structure that was different from Conan Doyle, and yet I still wanted it to feel and read like his short stories. So that means amping up the pacing a bit. Also, if you look structurally, I think I mentioned that I've been a screenwriter and I teach screenwriting at UCLA Extension.
Yep.
So I deal a lot with structure. When you change structure from a short form like a short story or one act play to a long form, which is a novel or a screenplay, then structurally it's almost like, if you think of these as a bridge, a short story is like one of those little arced Japanese bridges that goes over a stream. So it's like a single arc.
Mm-hmm.
But a novel or a long form is like a suspension bridge over a wider body of water. So you have more support posts. And in storytelling, those support posts are the things that hold it up. But in storytelling, they are key scenes. They are key scenes of emotion or of action or character change, and preferably all three at once. So, you know, a lot of reviews have said, you know, this is action-packed and sort of cinematic, my book. And it is true. There is a fair amount of action. And my detractors have said, you know, it's much more action-filled than Conan Doyle, but in fact, that's not true. The canon is filled with, you know, chases, and Holmes flings himself over sofas and gets in fist fights and boxes, and, you know, people shoot at them and people have their fingers cut off. And I mean, it's full of crazy, you know, wild action if you take it, you know, in the aggregate. But in a single Conan Doyle short story, there is usually only one moment of this, if there's going to be any. Some of them have none. Some of them are all kind of cerebral, but many of them have a moment of action. People throw acid in people's faces. I mean, it's quite, you know, quite dramatic stuff. So
it's good
fact,
for a 10-year-old to kind of get involved in that, the acid in the face thing. That's a good,
yeah,
that's a good 10-year-old plot.
Well, yeah. Kids love to be, you know, thrilled. You know, they love the horror, the
chills.
Oh,
absolutely.
It's like, you know, it's like,
yeah,
it feels like you're doing something forbidden when you read these. So Conan Doyle has these big moments and these very action-packed moments, but like I said, they're maybe one per story, if you know, and like I said, not in every story. So, but I realized that in a novel, you know, it's a longer, you know, like a suspension bridge, it's a longer span. So structurally, it actually needed more of these support posts, these high points. So that was kind of an intellectual decision up front, a choice that I made. But the other thing is that I mentioned a little bit earlier that Conan Doyle's style, you know, his storytelling style, was different, was noticeably different from his contemporaries, because he was much crisper. So Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories are almost all told in first person from the voice of Dr. Watson. And Dr. Watson is not the bumbling guy we think of as Nigel Bruce in the movies. He's actually an army doctor. He's a war hero. He was injured in battle. He's a crack shot. He's a gambler. He's a ladies' man. And he's very funny. And contrary to Holmes' assessment, you see but you do not observe, Watson is very observant. And, you know, you get that when he's telling the story because he observes the client. Now, he doesn't draw the same inferences that Holmes does about the details he sees, and that's the fun part. But he is very observant, and he's particularly observant about his friend, Holmes. So you know, it's a delightful point of view to be in. It's really fun to be Dr. Watson on the page, because he's a great character himself. But because it's narrated by this man of action himself, the narrative is crisp. So he doesn't spend a lot of time kind of romantically describing the light on the snow and the whistling of the trees. And he does this in passing, but quickly just boom, set the scene and tell the story. So he's much more direct and action oriented than other writers of his time. Of course, and he was writing in the short form, so that's also part of that. But when you extend that to a longer form, you get the feel and the pace that we're used to as modern readers. So you also said earlier that, you know, well, you've used a little Jack the Ripper, you've put him on drugs. But I should mention that Jack the Ripper doesn't feature in this story. There's some wonderful books that pit Holmes against Jack the Ripper. In my book, it's just post the Ripper, so it takes place in December of 1888. The last known Ripper murder was in November of that year. Of course, they don't know that he's gone at this point. But it was kind of a fiasco for the police, and because the Ripper was never identified.
Right.
And there are people who debate that, but I'm not going to go there right now. But you know, so it's kind of a disaster. And so in the theory of mine, it's just a launch point. It doesn't feature in the story. But my theory in this was that he was involved, or he was called in, but in any case, something happened, and he probably wasn't able to complete his investigation. So my idea was that he ran afoul of somebody in the law, possibly somebody way, way higher in the government, and he got thrown into jail briefly for, quote, tampering with the evidence. So basically the story picks up, he's just gotten out of jail, but it's been a very traumatic experience for him. And I base that on another thing that I was decided to set out. In addition to having more of these suspension post, to sustain the longer form, in addition to having more action and so forth, I think a long form piece of writing requires a little thematic content. So, you know, kind of an area that you're exploring. And do you want to ask me something about that or?
No, I mean, I think that the good thing that you've been able to do it, you know, like you said, you've been able to stay true to, what Conan Doyle was doing with Holmes and Watson, but then you're able to put your own different spin on it. So when people read, whether they've read, you know, all 56 short stories or whether they've just read one or two, you're able to fit your book within the realm of all of them. And I do have to say that for people who think you have to write a book to be successful, yeah, well, no, you don't, because 56 short stories, 150 years later, we're still talking about them.
Yeah.
What's the common thread? Write the best damn story or book you possibly can and make it work. And it doesn't make a difference if it's a short story or a novel. I mean, like you said, I mean, it's just, he's a timeless character, timeless writer. And for you to keep bringing it up and bringing it back into people, I think it's wonderful. And I love the enthusiasm, and I love the emotion, and I love everything that you've been able to put into this book. And even if you're not a Holmes or Corsorth or Conan Doyle, you know, kind of connoisseur, this is still a fabulous suspense mystery book that you've pinned together.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's been favorably received by the deepest Sherlockians, I would call them. You know, people who are really steeped in canon and very protective and loving of it. So, like the well-read Sherlockian and the Doylockian, and a number. I also, in order to that was one of my goals, was to have this be passable and liked by deep Sherlockians, of which I'm one, obviously, but also to really play well for somebody who's never touched Holmes. And the
right.
well-read Sherlockian in their review said that, or in a post they said, was this is kind of could be the gateway drug because to the whole canon. Because if you read my book and then you go, oh, Sherlock Holmes is pretty interesting, and then you turn to Doyle for the first time, perhaps, you will not feel like you're in foreign territory. It will feel similar. It will feel the same as much as possible. It will feel the same. And so, you know, it's a little hubris to say that, but it has been described by a lot of Sherlockians. I have Les Klinger was one of my advisors. I sought out advice,
yeah.
And I had the thing vetted a number of times. So Les Klinger in the U.S. is probably one of the, if not the foremost Sherlockian. He's in the country. He's written. He did the annotated versions, and he's done a number of things. He's just very well respected. He's a good friend. He vetted it. Also, Catherine Cook in the UK. And she's the curator of the Sherlock Holmes collection at the Westminster Library in London. And it was bought by the UK arm of HarperCollins. So it was actually
fabulous.
They were looking for Conan Doyle voice, and they were not expecting to find it from a woman from California.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, we got about 30 seconds to go, so I want to give you the last word to let everybody know where they can find out about you and all your social media, so hit it up.
Sure. Oh, thank you. My website is my last name. It's MacBird, MacBird, www.macbird.com. I'm at MacBird on Twitter. I blog as the Professional Enthusiast, which is a Sherlockian term, and I'm on Facebook, and so is the book, Art in the Blood.
Well, Bonnie, we want to thank you for being our last guest here of 2015 and closing up the show with none other than a Sherlock Holmes adventure. What better way to do it than that? So thank you so much for coming on. Good luck. And look forward to seeing what you got coming up next. If you're going to stay
well,
into this genre
much.
And you're going to write another Sherlock.
I'm working on a sequel now.
Absolutely. That's fabulous. So you have a good one, and thank you again.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is Bonnie McBird, and the book is called Art in the Blood. It's a Sherlock Holmes adventure. Check out McBird.com for more information on that. So we want to thank you all here for 2015. It's been an outstanding year. We've had some wonderful, wonderful guests, some great shows. Go back and listen to them. Everything is always listened to on demand. You can get it on iTunes by the podcast. It'll take you all the way back to the beginning if you want to. Or you can just go to blogtalkradio.com/suspensemagazine. And check out any of the shows you want to do. I always tell everybody, just go to iTunes and just get the podcast. If you don't like it, delete it. If you're not really into, you know, what's being talked about that day. But we are going to go strong in 2016. We always get surprises. We always have things coming up. So this should be a very, very exciting time for us. Our best of issue is looking to come out sometime this week. We were naming the Crimson Scribe Award winner for the best novel of 2015, along with all of the people who won. So make sure you check out that. So until next year, everybody, we want to say thank you and enjoy, and we will see you all real soon. Like we always like to say, just keep on reading. Till next time, have a good one.